It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look at how Wisconsin stacks up nationally when it comes to vaccination exemption policies.
First, after leading in the polls for months in Iowa, Wisconsin governor and Republican presidential candidate Scott Walker now appears to be slipping there. The most recent CNN-ORC poll shows that Walker has now fallen to third place behind Donald Trump and Ben Carson.
Political insiders say that winning Iowa is crucial to Walker's chances at winning the nomination. So with that in mind, how has Walker's campaign been responding? And how much stock should we be putting in these early polling numbers?
Joining us now is Matthew DeFore. He's a reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal who's been covering Walker's presidential campaign. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Veronica, thanks so much for having me.
Well, since the debate, Governor Walker's been slipping in the polls in Iowa. How big a drop has he seen?
Well, if you look at the course of the last several months since his breakout performance in January at the Iowa Freedom Summit, he was as high as 25% in one poll in February and been in the 20s and in the teens. This is before he even got in the race. But, he's certainly slid quite a bit in Iowa, and he's been up in other states as well and nationally, and he's coming back down to earth perhaps as this race has just gotten completely muddled with the emergence of Donald Trump.
Well, is this thinking here that Governor Walker's debate performance is the reason for the drop? It seems like that's when we started to see these numbers sinking.
Well, Trump actually took the lead in Iowa polls in late July before the debate. So I don't know if it's entirely because of the debate. I mean, I think what was noteworthy about the debate for Walker was that he really did not show up in any of the discussion afterward. He wasn't in the top three and he wasn't in the bottom three. He was very in the middle. And because of that, he wasn't getting any attention. I mean, even Trump, who's still leading, was being talked about negatively, but still being talked about. And so for Governor Walker, he is he's just kind of in the middle right now, and that's not generating a lot of buzz about his potential candidacy.
Right, and Walker himself, in doing a postmortem on his debate performance, has said people told him that he didn't do anything wrong, but people weren't feeling the passion. Is that your read on it too?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many candidates in the field right now that. I mean, I'm talking to people in Iowa who are saying that there's just, no one really knows what's going on. It's, you see Trump surging, but I think he's representing an idea that Walker represented when he first emerged in January. And that is this anti-establishment. People want to change from the way things are going in Washington. You know, Walker, when he emerged, was an outsider because he was a governor from a state and he had done a lot of things. And those things are still working in his favor. People still give him credit for those. Republicans still give him credit in Iowa for what he's done in Wisconsin. But he's no longer the bright, shiny object, and Donald Trump is. And, we even see Ben Carson and Carly Fiorina, who are also viewed as outsiders, surging in the polls. And so he's just he had captured that idea early on. But, people's attention so far has been going all kinds of different directions.
So with that in mind, in this incredibly crowded field, what is Governor Walker plan to do moving forward to redistinguish himself again in the eyes of would-be primary voters?
Well, it's interesting. The Washington Post had a story out yesterday that talked about this call he had with his donors, his top donors on Monday, in which he was suggesting that he was going to take on a more he was going to challenge his own party even in Washington. It sounds a little bit like he's going to follow in the Trump model a little bit, trying to capture those voters. He, like other candidates like Ted Cruz and a couple others, are sort of positioning themselves to capture the, I think everyone's thinking that Trump is eventually going to, fall apart. People are not going to end up voting for him in the end. And so they're trying to position themselves to capture that huge pile of, at least poll support that Trump has right now. So he did things at the Iowa State Fair, like say that his immigration plan is similar to Donald Trump's, and even suggested at one point that he was, in favor of getting rid of birthright citizenship, which is protected by the 14th Amendment. So he's certainly positioning himself on the right to capture those voters. But he's getting some flack from his donors, some of his donors, who don't want him to attack hard to the right.
We're talking right now to Matthew DeFore, who's been covering Scott Walker's presidential campaign for the Wisconsin State Journal. We're talking about Governor Walker's slumping poll numbers in Iowa. Now, another thing that happened at the Iowa State Fair is Governor Walker tangled with protesters there. He said, "You do not intimidate me, sir." Is this an example of a kind of more Trump-like maybe anger that he's trying to tap into now?
Well, I think he's trying to replay his greatest hits. I mean, this is his calling card on the campaign trail, and that's what we saw back in January. You know, in that speech, it was what was notable was he had this fire in his belly about the fact that he had faced down all these protesters back in 2011. And so what he's doing there is he's trying to reinvigorate among the electorate this idea of, I'm this fighter, I took on the protesters, I took on the unions in Wisconsin. And so he, I think, was the campaign is, I think, looking to capitalize on video of that interaction to show that he can he's going to be a fighter in Washington to bring about some changes, and that is what his message has been about long before Trump was even on the map. So.
Well, you said he also wanted to show that he's going to take on the Republican establishment. Now, how is that playing out? Doesn't he sort of need some of the Republican establishment to back his campaign?
You know, he's been viewed as a possible bridge candidate, somebody who can get wide support from both the conservative activists, the base, if you will, and from the more establishment Republicans who like his. Just the way he's been governing in Wisconsin. I mean, it seems like he has that potential, but it's unclear, which direction, if he goes hard to one side, whether that'll alienate the other side. And like I said, that Washington Post article quoted a donor, a billionaire from Minnesota, who is right out saying that he doesn't appreciate the governor's position on certain social issues, that he shouldn't be trying to talk up certain social issues like abortion and same-sex marriage. And so it's a tough balancing act. It's a high-wire act, and he's certainly trying to muddle his way through that right now.
Now, it's still so early in this presidential campaign. Is it too early to be reading the tea leaves, or should he be worried about these slumping poll numbers before the Iowa poll?
Well, certainly his campaign manager, Rick Wiley, I saw him tell the New York Times that it's August, poll numbers are meaningless. And that's pretty much true. I mean, as much as his poll numbers have dropped, it's because, largely, Donald Trump's poll numbers are surging. And a lot of people just don't think that Trump is going to be the nominee. And so it's creating this, his support has to come from somewhere. But in the end, when people are in the voting booth, are they going to pull the lever for Donald Trump? Maybe they will, or maybe over the course of these debates that, he will no longer be the bright, shiny object, and there will be some sort of a leveling of the playing field for everyone.
On the other hand, for weeks now, we've been hearing about Governor Walker. He's got to win Iowa. He's got to win Iowa. Well, does he have to win Iowa, and how come?
That was certainly what we were hearing when he announced, when he got in the race. That's what people were saying. I don't think that's changed, but anything can happen. The question then becomes, if he doesn't win Iowa, where does he go next? And will that, kind of like a mediocre debate performance, if he comes in third or fourth in Iowa, how can he recapture any kind of momentum? And so especially if he's not the front runner going into Iowa, if he's got these middling expectations, he's still a governor from a neighboring state who should have the ability to win Iowa. And if he doesn't, especially the national media are going to read that as a, stick a fork in it kind of, they're going to basically declare that he won't be able to advance. I'm sure his campaign will continue to push forward and look to the south, the southern primaries on March 1st. And, he certainly has a. It's going to be completely unpredictable throughout, at least in these next few months. So we'll see what happens.
So the next GOP debate is going to happen on September 16th. What do you expect to see Governor Walker do differently there? Is he going to come out swinging?
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't know exactly how he'll, you know, specifically change his approach. You know, I remember in the first debate, Rand Paul sort of came out swinging. If you mean to come out swinging, I remember Rand Paul had that sort of initial pushback against Donald Trump, and you know, got tussled with Chris Christie. I don't know that he benefited from trying to be real aggressive and forward. So there may be that caution still, but yeah, he will not be well served by just, again, another mediocre performance. I mean, after the first debate, his national poll numbers, I think the one blog sort of pointed out that he had the biggest drop of all the candidates, including Trump and Bush. And, you know, so he does not want to see that continue and certainly wants to make more of a splash.
Well, Matt, thanks a lot for talking today.
Veronica, thanks so much for having me.
That was Matthew DeFore, who's been covering Scott Walker's presidential campaign for the Wisconsin State Journal. He joined us to talk about Governor Walker's slumping poll numbers in Iowa. First, a new study out this month takes a look at how state vaccination exemption laws affect immunization rates and the incidence of preventable disease in the United States, using whooping cough as an example.
The study found that lax state vaccination laws contribute to lower immunization rates and increased outbreaks of preventable diseases. In addition, the study also ranked Wisconsin as one of the states with the least effective vaccination exemption policies. So, what should that mean for our state going forward?
Study author David Bradford is with us now. He's a professor and chair in the public policy for the Department of Public Administration and Policy at the University of Georgia. David, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Well, before we dig in, can you run us through what the study found about immunization rates as they relate to state laws?
Sure. So what we found in this study, one of the things that we wanted to try to do was to understand how state laws affected immunization rates, and more precisely, we wanted to look at exemptions that people got from the requirement to have their child immunized when they showed up for school. And one of the difficulties with studying this area is that there are so many different laws that states can have, and you know, dozens of different flavors of the laws, and so it's hard to know which combinations lead to better or worse outcomes. You know, better outcomes, of course, being higher rates of immunizations and vaccinations. So we ran some statistical analyses looking at, you know, about a dozen or so, a bit more than a dozen different types of laws, and how they contributed to the rates of exemptions that states saw, so that we were able to then rank states from, you know, the most effective to the least effective, where most effective means very few exemptions and more immunizations, and least effective, of course, means lower vaccination rates. And this was a way of trying to consolidate many, many different dimensions down into one dimension.
And you looked at whooping cough to give you the clearest example of what was going on. What did you find?
Well, what we found mostly was that that while, you know, there was some difference between, you know, states that ranked most effective and moderately effective in our rankings, mostly it was the least effective states that had the statistically different rates of whooping cough or pertussis, and the least effective states in our index had much higher rates of whooping cough than did the other states in the country.
So when people aren't getting vaccinated for pertussis or whooping cough, they may be using exemptions to do so. What kind of exemptions do people generally use?
Well, there are a variety of exemptions that are possible. I mean, every state allows for a medical necessity. Of course, there are a number of reasons that that children and adults, and particularly older adults, might not be able to be vaccinated or get the vaccine prescriptions that they need. If you have a suppressed immune system, for example, that would be one reason. So everybody gives medical exemptions, but a number of states allow other kinds of exemptions as well. For example, one of the big ones is to permit a religious or a philosophical exemption. Those are actually two separate categories. And this, of course, is just a statement by the parent that they have some, you know, the religion prohibits them from giving their child vaccination, or that they have some belief, non-religious belief, that leads them to not wish to have their child vaccinated. In many states, in order to do that kind of thing, the parent needs to actually write out an affidavit and in some states have it notarized and give it to the school, and then they can be granted an exemption on that basis. Other states, and Wisconsin is one of these states, have a standardized form that makes it very easy. For example, the Wisconsin school immunization record is a form that you can download and fill out and bring to the school for your child's first day of school. And there it's very easy to get a religious or a personal conviction exemption simply by checking a box on the form, which you have to bring in anyway, and with the checkbox in, you can exempt your child from having to have the vaccinations.
So a philosophical exemption might be something like, I believe vaccines are harmful.
Exactly. There has been, particularly in the 2000s in this country, a discussion about the potential for vaccines to cause harm. Around 2007 in particular, there was sort of nationwide a discussion that was led by some celebrities that were citing since withdrawn study that was published in The Lancet that seemed to connect the MMR vaccine to autism. It was a very poorly done study on an extremely small set of people, and it has been withdrawn, and the medical community has sort of said this has no basis in fact. And yet, you know, when Jenny McCarthy and some others went on national television to talk about it, this actually did raise a lot of concerns from parents, and you began to see an acceleration in this wave of exemptions that were being requested around the country. And interestingly, it's sort of an affluent phenomenon, and there's more affluent communities that tend to have the higher rates of these philosophical exemptions for their kids.
We're talking to David Bradford, professor in public policy at the University of Georgia, talking about how Wisconsin stacks up nationally when it comes to vaccination exemption policies. And Wisconsin was not among the most effective. In fact, it was among the group of least effective states. What did you find when you looked at states like Wisconsin?
Well, so the problem was that states like Wisconsin, and Wisconsin is in a group, for example, in 2012, that would include Minnesota and Michigan, Texas, Washington, and Vermont. I mean, these are states that we typically think actually, on the whole, tend to be in the better end of the spectrum on the health basis, and yet they tended to have the least effective portfolio of exemption policies. And that is, the policies that Wisconsin and the other states have tended to be the sort that were associated with more exemptions. Interestingly, the two states really that at that time led the country were Mississippi and West Virginia. Those were then the only two states that didn't allow any kind of exemptions except for a medical exemption. California has since joined the ranks of those states, and Jerry Brown, the governor out there, I think signed a bill a few months ago that removed anything except for a medical exemption from California.
So Wisconsin has more exemptions and, as a result, lower vaccination rate. What about those states that have the most effective vaccination policies, the higher rates? What do they have in common?
They have in common the biggest impact or the biggest drivers of cutting down on the number of exemptions would be to, for example, to not have a philosophical exemption. That actually allowing for a philosophical exemption and, like Wisconsin, having the standard form where parents basically have to submit the immunization record and either check philosophical exemption or don't check it. Those two things are the biggest drivers that raise the number of exemptions that occur in the states and therefore drive down the vaccination rates. Requiring parents to do things like submit separate requests for exemptions for each kind of vaccine, having the health department approve any non-medical application, or even having civil penalties associated with not vaccinating your child. These are the sorts of policies that tend to drive exemptions down and vaccination rates up.
Now, sometimes when parents choose not to get their children vaccinated, they say there's herd immunity. Enough other kids are vaccinated that the disease is not going to be prevalent. Tell us a little bit, as we wrap up here, what happens to herd immunity when fewer kids get vaccinated?
Well, the whole point of trying to get as many people vaccinated as possible is in Exactly that, to get herd immunity. Because, as I said at the beginning, there are a number of people, young children and older adults, and elderly people in particular, who can't be vaccinated or can't have their boosters. They depend upon herd immunity for their protection. But in order to get herd immunity for most of the diseases that we vaccinated against, you need 95% and higher immunization rates. And in fact, the immunization rates have gone down so much in this country that there are places that, as of, you know, the 2012-2013 school year, for example, that as a state even fell below the level necessary for herd immunity. Oregon was one state like that. Wisconsin would have been right on the borderline with about 96% or so immunizations. But another problem is that even within states, there are pockets, again, as I said, this is sort of an affluent community issue, there are pockets of areas, counties, and areas of cities that have very low immunization rates that might have, you know, only 80 or 85% immunization, and that drives those communities well below what's necessary for herd immunity and puts people there at extreme risk.
David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was David Bradford, professor and chair in public policy for the Department of Public Administration and Policy at the University of Georgia. He joined us to talk about how Wisconsin stacks up nationally when it comes to vaccination exemption policies. If you have kids or grandkids, you probably found yourself cooking or ordering special foods just for them.
And just about any restaurant that welcomes families will have a separate kids menu that features spaghetti, chicken fingers, or maybe a hot dog or PBJ.
But if you travel abroad or know children being raised in other countries, you may have noticed that the U.S. might be unique in catering to children's limited eating preferences.
Joining us to talk about the concept of children's food is Gail Coleman. She's a specialist with the UW Extension Nutrition Education Program. Gail, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, when we talk about children's food in the United States, what are the most common things?
Oh, I tend to think about, you know, if I go to a restaurant, they've got fried chicken fingers or macaroni and cheese or maybe pizza, hamburger. Not a very varied menu.
And not a lot of fresh food, it sounds like.
No, it tends to be the things that are either sweet or maybe salty. Right, not a lot of the fruits and vegetables or things like that.
And you call children's food a modern myth. What do you mean by that?
Right. Well, it's really interesting when you think back to the early 1900s. That's when people that were doing marketing realized that if they marketed something specifically for kids or to children, they could really increase their sales on some of those items. And then, of course, when the media grew and the introduction of television and these messages were broadcast all over the country, the advertising really took off, and you started to see a lot more of, you know, toys or prizes in children, in cereals that were geared for children or snacks that were geared for children. And in restaurants, you started to see special meals or special menus just for children. So it really took off. And of course, now we have social media, and you see advertisements when you open up your computer, when you check your phone, things like that. So these messages are all around, and I think they've actually convinced a lot of adults that you need special foods or there are certain foods that are specifically for children, and that's really not true.
Well, and I think that the idea is that kids won't eat the things that adults are eating or that the whole family is eating, but what is it like in other countries? Are we really unique in this?
Oh, that's a really good question. So when you think about over time through history, and when you look at what people are eating in other countries, let's say it's a country where they eat a lot of spicy foods, the children tend to eat what the adults eat over time. I mean, young infants, of course, are not going to be
not putting a Thai chili right. pepper in their bottle
exactly.
or anything.
But children really learn from their family members and their friends, you know, what are foods that they can eat. And the more they're exposed to these foods, the more their taste develops to appreciate the flavors.
What do you put that down to? Is it that Americans aren't cooking as much as, say, parents in France are, that they're not getting the education about food from an early age in the kitchen?
Well, it's probably a combination of factors, but I think the biggest things are marketing. I mean, really, advertising has a really strong effect. You know, if you see children's television, for example, you see a lot of ads for, again, very sweet foods, and those are the things that then the children are asking their parents for. There's actually a term for some of that advertising. It's called pester power, where the children will pester their parents to get to purchase something that they've seen advertised as fun, you know, maybe with cartoon characters or, again, prizes or sports figures or things like that. So that's a piece of it as well.
Is part of what we're talking about, this concept of kids' food and what kids will eat, kind of projecting that on kids, is that part of a broader American cultural factor of where we really treat kids as very separate from adults? It's not so much of a continuum, but it's like they're kids, they're adults, and you're treated one way when you're this age and a different way when you get to, say, 18.
Yeah, I think sometimes there is that mindset, but really, and this really goes along with tastes as well, children learn to become adults, or they grow into adults, and the same way with food, you know, they learn to like foods. If a child doesn't like a food the first time, that's pretty natural, especially if it's not sweet or salty, because those are flavors that are more readily accepted. But something that might be a little bit bitter or sour, it may take exposure to the food multiple times. Now, that's not to say that everybody's going to like every food. My son said to me when he was probably about 12, "Mom, you told me after I tried this broccoli at least 12 times I'd like it, and I'm still not liking it." So, you know, not every food appeals to every person, but people's tastes do develop. And if you think about maybe an example for yourself, I know I wasn't a coffee drinker when I was a child because coffee was bitter. But I love coffee now. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like I kept tasting it because I wanted to be more of an adult, and I wanted to learn to like it, and now I do. So our tastes can develop over time, and we need to expose children to the variety of tastes so that they do develop these tastes. And I'm not saying forcing. I mean, we really want to encourage children, you know, making it an adventure to try something new, make it fun to try something new. Maybe going into a restaurant, you're going into a restaurant, and rather than ordering off the kids' menu, maybe asking, you know, what would you like to try? And if it's something off the adult menu, maybe they're tasting something that you're eating because maybe the portion's too large or you want to
split the portion. Is probably big enough to share.
Right. Or maybe, you know, they're ordering something like an appetizer that isn't as overwhelming for a child as far as size.
Is there anything different about kids' palates, the way that they experience the flavor of food? Or if we were just to sit them down and on these kids' menu, there would be steak and lobster and lentils, would they be just as likely to like those foods as an adult would?
There are some differences with children. You know, again, they have a natural tendency to like things that are sweet and salty. They see that even with infants, you know, if they give them something. But they will develop their tastes over time, and you know, even with adults, their taste can change as well. I mean, when you think about some of the extremes, children are probably much more sensitive to taste, and older adults have lost some of that taste sensation. So things do change over time, and there may be some things that, will appeal to adults more because they've developed those tastes, and maybe they want something a little bit spicier because they're not as sensitive to some of the seasonings.
We're talking with Gail Coleman. She's a specialist with the UW Extension Nutrition Education Program, and we're talking about the concept of children's food and what kids will eat and won't eat. So, Gail, we've talked about some of these big picture influences, marketing and other things, but what about in a family setting? Do children start eating only some foods, or do parents start only offering them those limited options? I guess I'm wondering what the dynamic is. Is there a chicken and an egg?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good question as well. Because, yes, there are a lot of parents that, you know, they want to please their child. They don't want to waste food if a child doesn't like it. But there are certainly things that families can do to encourage children to eat a variety of foods. I think probably the first thing is the expectation that, you know, these are the foods that we're having for this meal, and this is what you have to choose from. I'm not going to be a short order cook and make you a pizza if the rest of the family is eating lasagna or something like that. So that's one thing that can be taken into account. The other thing is, you know, parents and siblings should really be role, or it would be good for them to be role models as well, because if parents aren't willing to try something different or eat certain foods, you know, children see that and they learn from that, that, well, if they're not willing to eat that vegetable, then I'm not going to eat it either. So being a role model, having the expectation that what's available for the meal is what everybody's going to be eating, those are a couple of the things that could be done.
Well, once a child has gotten used to eating those kids' menu items for several years, did the parents blow it, or is there still a chance for them to help their kid get out of that food rut?
I think there's always a chance. You know, kids go through phases as well. It's pretty typical that a toddler, for example, is going to be really hesitant to try new foods. And again, they think, you know, back in history, there's probably a reason for that, because once children are more independent and can be out in, on their own choosing foods, you want them to be a little bit more hesitant about trying different things, because you don't want them to poison themselves or get sick. So kids kind of go through that phase. But then as they get a little bit older, you know, they might likes to be more adventuresome, or they might appreciate being having something that's fun. So, you know, people can change their attitudes and their thoughts about things at any age.
I actually remember my daughter being quite young and trying olives, and, you know, like pretty heavily cured olives, and, you know, couldn't stand them. I think there might have even been spitting out involved. But she willingly tried them a couple years later and ended up liking them. So mm-hmm. I think palates change, and also just what seems to be food to mm-hmm. them changes as well.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
We'll continue our discussion with Gail Coleman in a moment, but we also want to hear from you. Do you make different food for your children, or do they eat what the rest of the family is having?
If your child wants those children's foods, those very specific and limited foods, where do you think that those tastes and preferences come from? And do you have any advice and tricks to share for expanding a child's taste?
We hope you'll join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We're continuing our conversation with nutrition educator Gail Coleman about kids' food and why she says it's a modern myth.
And we want to hear from you. Do you find yourself making a whole different meal for your children, or do they eat what the rest of the family is having?
Were you a picky eater as a child yourself, and where do you think kids learn to eat just that limited option of mac and cheese and hot dogs from?
Join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or emailing us at talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We go to our callers now. We've got Tony on the line with us in Fenimore. Tony, hi.
Hello. In my family, growing up, we had to try whatever was on the plate. If we didn't like it, my mom had to at least make us try it once. And if we didn't like it, we were allowed to finish the meal, but we couldn't have anything extra, like dessert. If we couldn't have dessert, or if we didn't try that, we couldn't have dessert. But if we tried it, we could have the dessert. But basically, we had to try. And that was the biggest thing. And she knew that I hated peas. I still hate peas today. I'm 44 years old. I hate peas.
All right.
But we had to try it every time.
All right. Thanks, Tony. Still hates peas, but he had to try everything. And that was the rule in their house. Is that a good rule of thumb? The one try at least? Or maybe it takes several tries?
Yeah, I think it's a good idea to encourage children to try something, but not force them to eat everything. I mean, because it might, again, it might take trying something multiple times. And a child might just kind of lick something at first or sniff it a little bit. I mean, they may not actually chew it, or they might chew it and then spit it into a napkin. So that, you know, that is a good strategy for parents to use. I want to comment on your pea example, though, because I will say I have learned to like peas, and there's a reason for it. When I was growing up, we used to have really overcooked canned peas, and that's why I thought, oh, these just don't taste very good. But, you know, I had to keep trying them. But as I got older and then I started to taste fresh peas and frozen peas, I realized that, you know, maybe it's the way that you prepare them or the way that you serve them or the form that they're in. So I was glad that I did keep trying peas.
I think that's a great point, because I think depending on how something is prepared, it can have a very different, not just taste, but texture. And so I'm not saying that Tony needs to run out and, you know, try 10 different pea preparations, but maybe there are, especially with kids, saying, oh, okay, you don't like that. Well, you know, maybe next week we'll try to roast that instead of boiling it or something like that, and encouraging them to not think of it as a black and white situation.
Exactly.
Let's go back to the phones, and Colette in Three Lakes is up. Hi, Colette.
Hi, I hope you can hear me.
Yes.
I think we're sort of coddling kids so much. My kids never really had a problem with trying different foods. Both my husband and I love to cook, and we're gourmets, and we always, and my husband was a chef, and they always just ate whatever food we ate. When they were babies, I just took the food we ate and put it in a blender, and they ate it. And I never made special meals for them. If they didn't like it, well, there's another meal coming up in 3 hours. Kids are not going to starve themselves. Eventually, they're going to eat. They're going to eat something. My sister took the other approach and was constantly making little meals. And her son is 16 now, and he will only eat cheese and bread, which is not never. And she doesn't bother her, but it bothered me. And we never made a big deal of it. Well, here we're having curried eggplant with couscous tonight. This is what we're having. And so they just eat everything now. And they're very adventurous eaters.
Thanks for that call, Colette. Gail, do you think, I mean, there must be some level of a personality towards being very timid about eating or being really adventurous, but the just setting up that expectation that this is what's for dinner, you know, you're welcome to have as much as you want or you'll be hungry. Is that an okay approach to take?
That is true. And you're right. People have different personalities, and the same thing applies to with their food. Some people may be more adventuresome. Some people might be more hesitant to try something. They want to see if somebody else likes it first. So that is true. But yes, if you have that expectation that this is what we're having for dinner, this is what's available, children will eat. You're right. They're not going to starve themselves.
We're hearing about the advantages of cooking fresh and having home-cooked things, thinking about Tony's peas and your canned peas. Parents may like to put those fresh peas on the table, but canned peas are easier when you're strapped for time. So what do you do when you want to encourage your kids to eat different things, but you yourself, you know, you may not be able to get into that kitchen and cook that freshly cooked homemade meal?
Yeah, I appreciate the fact that there are challenges with time and priorities. I mean, you have working moms and dads that come home and maybe they want to spend some quality time just hugging their kids and sitting down and talking to them, and they don't have the time to make a home-cooked meal or something like that. Fortunately, we do have a wide range of, you know, lightly processed foods and really healthy foods that you can choose from. Even it's still not limited to a handful of foods like fried chicken strips and pizza and hamburgers and mac and cheese.
So use some of them, but maybe not all of them.
Right.
Well, and actually that brings up a really interesting point, Gail, because it doesn't seem like it has to be an either or. Either we're spending time with our kids or we're cooking good meals. I mean, what role can helping kids understand how meals are made or even how vegetables are grown, how can that encourage them to maybe be a little more adventurous if they're actually taking part in the process?
Oh, that's a great, those are great strategies for encouraging kids to make healthier choices and eat a greater variety of food. I'm not saying that the mac and cheese and things like that are not healthy at all or anything. That's fine. It's just you don't want a steady diet of just a handful of foods.
Or as our caller said, just bread and cheese.
Right, right. So yes, getting your kids in the kitchen to help with preparing and, you know, if you're growing a garden and they're helping with growing the food, they are more likely to taste the food if they've helped to prepare it, if they've helped to choose it in the grocery store or maybe at the farmer's market, or they've helped to grow it.
And it seems like they're also gaining life skills that way as well.
Yes. And plus, it's quality time with mom and dad and siblings.
Is there a good rule of thumb about how many times to present a food to a child before you say, you know what, he really just doesn't like peas?
I have heard that question before, and when you look at the research, I've seen a range of times. I think I've seen up to 30 times.
30 times.
But generally speaking, it's more like, you know, 10 to 15 times.
Well, that's still a significant amount of peas on a plate, though.
And some children, it won't take that long. But yes, okay, it could take a while.
And some, like our previous caller, it could be 300 and he's still not going to like peas. And that's okay. I mean, I'm a pretty adventurous eater and I like a wide range of things. And there are just a few things that I don't like and that might not change.
Yep. And there's nothing wrong with that.
We'll get you to like them, Judith. We'll keep presenting them. You can tell us what they are later.
No.
Well, Gail, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about how to get the kids to try new stuff.
Okay, it was a pleasure to be here.
Well, we are speaking there with Gail Coleman, a specialist with the UW Extension Nutrition Education Program, and we've got a link to her article about children's food as a modern myth over on the Central Time Facebook page. You can keep the conversation going over there. Tell us how your parents approached your diet, and how did it work out for you? Do you eat that variety of foods, or do you still maybe have more of a limited range?